So I'd like to thank the IFST for inviting me to talk this morning. As I was introduced, I'm working at RSSL. I'm a principal scientist and work as a projects manager in our investigative analysis team. And a lot of the projects we work with are around things like adulteration, contamination, where products have gone wrong. We work in food and pharmaceutical and sofas. One of my big jobs in the last few years was to work on a big issue around sofas that make people itchy. We did a lot of work around some chemicals there. You may have seen some of the things in the news about that. I think one of the headlines in the Sun newspaper was "Toxic sofa killed my nan." So an awful lot of work on toxic sofas. In the space of a year, I took apart 900 sofas to try and understand the issue and to help the manufacturers in that case to try and understand what's going on with the product. So today, I'm going to talk to you about the history of food adulteration, to try and give you a background to the issue, to those of you who are not really aware. You would have seen stories in the press now about what's happening, but how has it changed over the centuries? So we'll have a bit of a definition at the beginning, a trip through history, what happened when we began to get more understanding around science and around the chemistry of adulteration and how that changed the public's view, but also the government's view of adulteration. What the drivers for adulteration are, so why do people actually need to adulterate food? Do they need to at all nowadays? And then where we are now. So what is adulteration? Well, the dictionary definition, if you adulterate something, you make it impure by adding extraneous, improper, I like that term, or inferior ingredients. Generally nowadays we consider the word adulteration to mean it's deliberate, but you can adulterate a product by mistake. It can pose a food safety risk, so the adulterant can be something that's pretty toxic, but it can also just be a quality or a legal issue. Good luck with the seat.
Yeah, there are spaces on
it. Leg comes always at the front.
Yeah.
It's unlike the days when I used to lecture and used to have to make everybody come to the front, so they didn't have to. That's right. And finally, on this side, sometimes the nature of the adulterant we know about, and so we know what we're looking for, we can actually plan to make sure that the suppliers that we've got coming in haven't got that adulterant in, but sometimes we don't know what we're looking for. And actually, across the world, adulteration means something slightly different. In the US, the FDA regulations, for adulteration of pharmaceuticals, it doesn't necessarily have to mean that there's something in the pharmaceutical that shouldn't be there. It can mean they didn't manufacture it properly, but it's still considered an adulterated product under US law. So the terms are sometimes different. But it's an ancient issue. It's nothing new. We have evidence of laws that go back to the Mosaic and Egyptian laws. And for those of you who aren't quite as awake as I was when I did the research for this, Mosaic means Moses, as opposed to a mosaic. Mosaic and Egyptian laws principally were around the prevention of contamination of meat. So some of that was around adulteration and some of that was around hygiene, because they understood the need for hygiene in their food production. There were also laws in India relating to prohibiting the adulteration of grains and edible fats. And already we can see that grains, edible fats and meats, high-value commodities, things that people are thinking of targeting in terms of making some money or substituting an inferior product. But if you look at the way that these laws perhaps were stipulated in those times, they weren't always about protecting us as a consumer. They were often about protecting tax revenue. So where there was a grain tax, adulteration of grain was probably highly regulated. Where there was a tea tax, adulteration of tea may well have been highly regulated. It wasn't about protecting what we got, it was about protecting the income of the exchequer. So we have evidence that the Greeks and the Romans knew all about adulterating wine and olive oil, two big things in their lives. Particularly the Romans, with wine, they put some nice things in their wine, still adulterants, honey, herbs, mint, perhaps to just disguise that slight acidic off flavour for a slightly older wine, or the one they would have sent to Britain because we have no taste. But also the Greeks, wine originally was sold in amphoras, so oxygen, their permit was oxygen, so that got in, the wine went off really quickly, so they started resining the inside of amphoras, and that's where Retsina comes from, because they actually grew to like the adulterated taste of that resin, which protected the wine from oxidation. Olive oil was particularly prone to adulteration, and actually still is now. In particular, in Roman times, they had laws which were trying to prevent olive oil being adulterated with things from other parts of the tree. And they recognised that other oils could also be used. In the Middle Ages here, adulteration was quite rife. Things like bread, obviously everyone needs to eat bread. And actually, things have changed. In olden times, the poorer you were, the darker your bread was. You ate wholemeal bread if you were poor. The richer you were, the whiter your bread was. Actually, nowadays, you find the other way around. The poorer you are, you're probably eating white bread. And the richer you are, you're probably eating wholemeal bread. But people put things into bread to make sure that they stayed white and they looked like a high-value product. They also adulterated high-value commodities, such as pepper and spices, expensive things to bring into England in those days. And actually, it was profitable for them to make peppercorns out of bark rather than sell real peppercorns. Somebody sat and carved them, and it was still profitable enough for the adulterators and for the foresters to make money from that. They also adulterated butter. I'm not quite sure how they adulterated butter in those days, but presumably by adding stretching oils and agents to it. They didn't have the power of margarine, for example, or the technology of the chemistry that we have nowadays to stretch out our spreads. But because of all these adulteration issues and the politics of the time, the king recognised that bread was very important and bread was what made people move, work and live. They actually brought in the assizes of bread laws around the 13th century, which actually said that bread had to be a certain size and shape and could only contain certain ingredients. And that actually controlled some of the adulteration of bread for several centuries. So we have the Roman civil law documentation, which talks about the falsification of olive oil. And then we also have the trade guilds that were set up in the Middle Ages, alongside the assizes. As trades got together, they realised that, honourable tradesmen realised that, well, if someone down the road is selling something that's a bit dodgy, that's making us all look bad. It's a little bit similar to some of perhaps the FDF getting together nowadays, or the FDF, FDE, Europe, our trade associations still all work for the power of everyone to make sure that our products don't get a bad press. And these trade guilds set up in the Middle Ages provided control and supervision over the honesty and integrity of their members. And actually, they were very much like the mafia. Once you were in, you were in, you couldn't get out. And it was quite difficult to get in at the time. So, some examples of what happened in those trade guilds. In France, there was a town in Maine, and this is quite salient for the moment. The guild law required that before a butcher could display beef for sale in his shop, two witnesses should attest that the animal had been brought to him alive. If only that had happened on the June time this year. Similarly, butchers seem to have a bad time in France. In Poitiers, butchers were examined physically and morally to assure they were not scrofulous or had no bad breath. I'm not quite sure why your butcher shouldn't have bad breath. Maybe that's a sign of illness, and so then he shouldn't be handling food. But moving on to the UK, back to the UK, we first see the signs of our original auditors come into play. So those of you in the audience who are involved in auditing, it's been around a long time. The first evidence that we have of auditors are a group of people called the Conners, which actually nowadays sounds like they're a bit dodgy. But they tasted and pronounced on the quality of ale. They could ruin a man's business by saying your ale isn't good enough, you're not allowed to sell it anymore. And they could also set the price of your ale. If they decided that it wasn't good enough, they could lower the price that you were allowed to charge for your ale. That was around the 1100s that they started working. A bit later on, a guild was formed, and I have to get the names right here, and they were a guild of peppers, spicers, garblers and grocers. And the pepperers and spicers had responsibility for the king's weights. So a little bit now, like we have LGC and the National Reference Laboratories, where they hold reference materials, peppers and spices had the king's weights, and that was the weight that the bread should be, the weight that the spice should be sold by. And actually the term grocer comes through from this, because there was a weight called the great beam, which in French was the grosse beam, and grosse got changed to grossiers, and eventually we ended up with grocers who sold things by weight. But it was all around making sure that the king's weights were right and the commodities that they were selling were the correct materials. And the final name in that weird group are the barbers. And this comes from Arabic, from sifting and sorting in Arabic. And what they did was sift and sort spice imports originally. So they used to check the spice was actually what it says it was when it was coming into the London ports. They started off doing that, but their powers grew, and pretty much any import that came in, they were checking the validity of those imports. So much so that they were probably doing that for around 400 years, until the 17th century, the rise of the East India Company. There was some politics involved, which meant that they had too much power, and politics meant that their power was reduced. And as the garbler's power reduced, food safety quality in the UK, or in England at the time, started to decrease again. And in London, there are a lot more reports around the adulteration of food after the garbler's power had been reduced. So there's a novel called The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker, written in 1771. It is a comedy, so not everything on here is true. Much like today, there's a little bit of exaggeration for comedic effect. But he wrote, "The bread I eat in London is a deleterious paste, mixed up with chalk and alum and bone and ashes, insipid to the taste and destructive to the constitution. The good people are not ignorant of this situation, but they prefer it to wholesome bread because it is whiter than the meal of corn," which is, in those days, was wheat. "Thus they sacrifice their taste and their health to a most absurd gratification of a misjudged eye, and the miller or the baker is obliged to poison them and their families in order to live by his profession." In other words, if your bread didn't look right, people didn't buy it. It didn't matter that it didn't taste nice. And although it sounds a bit disturbing that there's bone ashes, alum and chalk all in one loaf, it didn't always happen that it was all in one loaf. But there are examples where every single one of those things has been found as an adulterant in bread in the past. And in that similar time, there were different terms used for adulteration. Now we think of it as adulteration, all adulteration is bad. They were also known as rectifiers and sophisticators, i.e. somebody who fixes something, somebody who makes something seem a little posher than it was. So, just with that in the background of our minds, we can see that in the 18th century, people were in a situation where it was very much buyer beware. What you buy might be deleterious to your health. If it looks good, it may be too good to be true. So often the intent of that adulteration was around improving the appearance, the quality of a product. Sometimes the adulteration was economically motivated. Sometimes it was due to famine conditions. So if there was a poor bread harvest, a wheat harvest, then obviously people would need to adulterate in terms of bread. If there's a poor harvest in terms of another cash crop, then you see people thinking about ways that they can substitute mixed grains in those situations. But then, as a scientist, I'm a chemist, so I love the fact that eventually science came along and people started to understand chemistry and understand how they could figure out what things had been adulterated and how foods had been adulterated. And there was a chap in this age where everyone used to produce pamphlets, and it was a bit like the Daily Mail every day, that different people were writing different stories and producing their own pamphlets and leaflets and treatises around the issues of the day. And they were all discussed in their coffee shops. And a very famous one was produced in 1820 by a chap called Frederick Achim, who was actually German, but was working in London. And he was quite a famous chemist at the time. He was popular at the Royal Academy and the Royal Society, and did lots of public exhibitions. And people would go to him with chemical questions and ask him to sort these things out. So perhaps one of our first analytical labs, before we had analytical labs in the days before RSSL, long time before RSSL. So his little book, The Treatise of Adulteration of Food and Culinary Poisons, didn't really change anything at the time, but it did open people's eyes to the fact that the food they were eating was quite often not what they thought it was. The reason it didn't change things at the time was he actually got hounded out of the country for falsifying his research a couple of years later, and he didn't really have time to gain the momentum. And he describes things like custard poisoned with laurel leaves, and those of you who have ever chopped down a laurel in the garden will know it's actually not very good for you. tea falsified with slow leaves, again a high commodity product where you can dry something else and put it in and get away with it hopefully. Lozenges made from pipe clay and pickles coloured green with copper. He also recognised a supply chain issue, and I had to refer to my notes here because it gets quite complicated, and today we're talking about auditing and supply chains and how complicated they may be. This is back in the late 1700s, and it's around double Gloucester cheese. It was consumed by a gentleman in an inn. On three occasions after consuming double Gloucester cheese, he was ill, so he reported it to the mistress of the inn. She was horrified and said, "It's silly, that can't be my cheese." But then a maid said, "I gave the rind to the kitten and it died." Okay, so the mistress actually went to see Frederick Ackham and asked him, "What's wrong with this cheese? Can you tell me?" And he analysed it and found it contained red lead. Obviously, we all know now that lead's toxic, but only just then had they identified lead as a toxic poison. So what they did, the mistress went back to the cheese dealer and said, "Well, this cheese has got red lead in it." He went back to the farmer, who bought his annatto, a colouring to make the cheese nice and orange, from a travelling merchant, who said, "Well, I bought it from a usual man." And he went back to his usual man, who sold him the vermilion, which vermilion is harmless, but it was sold to him by a druggist, who thought it was going to be used for paint. So to make it nice and red, he added some red lead. So you can see, even in the 17th century, or 18th century, they had a food chain which was quite long. Long enough that the druggist at one end had no idea what that material was going to be used for at the other end. And I'd hate to say that we haven't learned any lessons from that food chain story, but I think we haven't learned many lessons from that food chain story. So some of the other things he found which were pretty disturbing. Again, chemistry now tells us strychnine is a deadly poison. It's also lovely and bitter. So if you add it to your rum and beer, it gives you a nice bitter kick. Sulfate of copper. And again, we know that copper is a micronutrient, but in too high doses, it's very toxic. Added to pickles, bottled fruit wine to give you preservative agents and colouring. And the red lead, obviously, in the Gloucester cheese. They used flour and arrowroot to thicken cream. Milk contained excessive water or excessive chalk. They added iron sulfate, which for those of you not particularly toxic, but does have a bit of a deleterious effect on your stomach, to tea and beer. And iron, ferrous cyanide, lime sulfate and turmeric in Chinese tea to give it colour, so to blacken it. And also coffee thin with chicory. Now, some of these things, when you look, you think coffee thin with chicory, well, it's not great, it's adulteration because you're being sold coffee. But actually, in times of war, when coffee wasn't available, chicory was a valid substitute. And so it shows that depending on the time and depending how the product is marketed, something we could consider an adulterant may also be a valid substitution as long as the consumer knows what they're getting. Another example might be flour and arrowroot used to thicken cream. Now, okay, if you bought your cream and it's lovely thick double cream, and it's fresh from the dairy, as we would buy it nowadays, that's great. But then you can also buy cream substitutes nowadays, which are thickened and emulsified with various additives. But again, we know those additives are present, and so it's not considered adulteration anymore, as long as you've been told what you're buying. It's a little bit difficult to read the bottom of this cartoon. And again, the great age of the press in this time. I'll read you the quote from the little girl. And this is a quote, this is a cartoon from Punch magazine. So satirical magazine of the day. And she's saying to the merchant, "Can I have another great carton, please, if you will, of a quarter of a pound of your best tea, because it kills the rats. And can I have an ounce of the chocolate because it gets rid of the beetles?" And then underneath, and now I've used the right pointer, we can see that actually underneath the merchant has red lead, sand. So this is a typical grocer. What's quite disturbing about this is that Punch really did tap into the themes of the day. In this sort of time, around the 1820s, England was recognised throughout Europe as masters of adulteration and fixing foods. In France and Germany, laws were already being enacted around the purity of foods, but England really hadn't caught up at that point. Another good cartoon, this is the Great Lozenge Maker, and this is probably the cartoon that tells the story of what really changed our food laws in Britain. It's called The Great Lozenge Maker because there was a scandal in the 1860s where several people died. Lozenges were made where arsenic was used by mistake, and it wasn't an adulteration where somebody was trying to pass something off as something else. It was just a contamination mistake, really. But several people died in the north of England. I think it was more than 20, and the British Parliament finally decided in 1860 that they would enact some legislation to look at the purity of food. And later on today, you'll be hearing from Elizabeth from the public analysts area, and that was really the beginning of the public analysts in the UK as well. There were two chaps, first of all John Mitchell, who repeated a lot of the work that Frederick Acton had done 20, 30 years later, and he found that the issue hadn't really gone away, that still bread was being adulterated, several other things were still being adulterated. And then following on from his work, there's a chap called Hassell, and he was really considered one of the first public analysts. He was actually sponsored by the editor of The Lancet at the time, Mr. Wigley. They analysed more than 2,500 samples of food, and Barbara can tell you, 2,500 samples of food, especially meat, it's quite a lot of samples to get through, and they found that a high proportion, more than 50% of them, weren't necessarily what they said they were. This went back to Parliament as well, and gradually the laws changed to bring in some rules around 1870 around the change in the law from buyer beware to seller beware. So finally, it wasn't just around the taxes that the government was getting, so tea was quite highly regulated because the government wanted their tax. It was about protecting the populace for the first time. Those laws were really about making sure that we got what we said we were getting. We weren't the only country around that time to start putting in legislation. New Zealand, pretty much the same time as us, and Canada. But the US were a little bit far behind. I think that's probably because they were fighting, cowboys and Indians were fighting. They didn't have time to worry about food safety. But it was a global issue. So in the US, the food safety debate wasn't really around necessarily adulteration. There was a lot of interference from the temperance movement. So there was a lot more politics involved in the issue. So they saw the temperance movement complaining about new additives that were being added to food. So preservatives, for example, they thought they were impure. There's actually a chap here who's shown on the stamp. He was the head of the chemistry section at the US Agriculture Department, which ultimately turned into the FDA. Or part of it turned into the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration in the US. And he was a little bit like Hassell in the UK, but about 30, 40 years behind. He did the work to show that there was a lot of adulteration in America. One of the examples that's in the literature is around milk in New York. 90,000 quarts of milk were produced in the counties around New York every day for the general populace. 120,000 quarts of milk were sold every day in New York. Now, everyone here can do the maths there. That means that somebody's either thinning that milk or selling something else. The quote that we have here, again, probably telling us a bit more of a story about meat than we really wanted to know now, related to a book called The Jungle, which was published around the turn of the 20th century, so coming in around 1905. And that book, there was a chap, he was actually a socialist reformer. He was really interested in the conditions of the people working in meat processing factories in Chicago around that time. There were terrible conditions, lots of people died. And when he was there, he also noticed the food safety conditions weren't that great as well. He actually witnessed someone fall into a boiling vat where they were rendering down pig fat. Nobody bothered to pull him out, and just left him to render. And that went into the food chain. And that caused a bit of a stir when he published that in his book. And that, combined with the work from Mr. Wiley, who was commemorated on a United States postage stamp, brought in some of the new food safety laws in the States and the Food and Drug Administration. It took them about 30, 40 years to get those rules working. But that great line, that this was in the New York Post after the book Jungle was published. Mary had a little lamb, and when she saw it sickened, she shipped it off to Packingtown, that's a pub, and now it's labelled chicken. And Packingtown is in Chicago, and where that Jungle book was researched. I think really the politics comes into play a little bit here. Wiley was a strange chap. he wasn't quite as messianistic as some of the reformists and the temperance movement, but he really took against modern chemistry, and as a chemist, obviously I'm not liking that very much, but he didn't really like additives, sweeteners, preservatives, and he actually set up a group called the Poison Squad. This was a group of supposedly healthy young men, and they used to feed them all these new additives to see what happened to them, and to see if they would die or not, and how toxic they were. I think that got disbanded reasonably quickly. But so some of the work was around adulteration, but some of it was around the political part of industry versus pure food producers. And already you can see there are some themes which still come through the press today. So killing young men to see whether aspartame is safe, one of his fine efforts. But the FDA do some good work. They don't just poison the Poison Squad. They won convictions against companies selling bogus fruit juices, honey, maple sugar, cream, olive oil, seafood, many others. Some specific examples: putting beet sugar or corn syrup in orange juice, substituting olive oil. That was a big scandal 3 years ago. Still, that's happening. Sugar and water, and hydrolyzed inulin syrup instead of apple juice. Corn oil in dairy cream, corn syrup in maple syrup, and sorghum syrups in honey. So you can see all of these very similar things where they've been substituted or blended to try and hide that it's not the high value product. Potato starch in horseradish. I can't believe anyone's really bothered to actually go to the effort of adding that potato starch in horseradish. And although that wasn't an adulteration as such, it was a mislabeling. The producer of the horseradish at the time went out of business because of that FDA prosecution. So they've also found salt and water in milk and sawdust in ginseng dietary supplements. And I guess something that's coming through that list, as you get to the end, sawdust in ginseng dietary supplements, you start to see the FDA has two roles. It protects food and it protects drugs in the States. And there is quite a fine line between some of the categories. And those dietary supplements and what's coming in from China and India, they're now recognised to be the experts at adulteration. It's no longer England. We're not great at adulteration anymore. But we are quite good at catching the people who are doing it. So now we have a rise of legislation. There's so much legislation that there's plenty of people make a lot of living about interpreting that legislation. National and international bodies design standards for this is the standard sugar, this is what sugar should be. This is the standard tea, this is what tea should be. There are analytical tests which then show you what those materials should be like and how they should behave under analytical conditions. So things like the Food and Agricultural Organization, the World Health Organization, CODEX and the EU, they all work together to try and bring those standards to a uniform thing across the world. Some people don't necessarily work to the same standards. The downside of publishing standards is that the fraudsters know what you're going to be measuring, and then they can figure out, well, what can we do to get around that? So the big melamine and milk scandal was all around fraudsters knew milk was sold, milk powder was sold on its nitrogen content, which was measured by measuring protein content, measured by measuring nitrogen. So they just put something in that had more nitrogen in to make the protein look bigger. And the tests and standards weren't able to detect that as a different material or as an adulterant. And so as we publish how we're going to detect these things, fraudsters can then figure out how they're going to work their way around. So the EU have also put a raft of legislation. If anyone really wants to read it, they could go to the EU website and read the tons and tons of legislation. But what's interesting is actually that the fraud legislation is slightly different to the food quality legislation. And there is actually a fraud blacklist. So if you've been caught fraudulently selling food in the EU now, you will be put on a blacklist and you're not allowed to sell any food for 6 months. It's not very long, I think. But 6 months is the time that you will serve. So now we move into the modern day. A lot of the background to this information is from a book here, which is a really good story. If you're interested in food adulteration over time, it's called Swindled, and it's written by B. Wilson. And you can see the little stories I've highlighted today to you are in that book. She moves on to the modern day, and it's interesting because she's a food writer as well as a journalist. And the way that she considers food fraud is quite different in the latter part of the book. So she almost moves to say that as we produce a low-fat spread, He's a manufacturer adulterating butter and producing something fraudulent to the consumer because that low-fat spread isn't quite what they think it is, because it's a mixture of water, emulsifiers, and just a very small amount of fat. The government's argument would be on one side, well, the consumer can read the label and it knows what's there. But actually, as food writers and the press sometimes would have us believe, the food manufacturers are all out to fiddle us and get the most money possible, not necessarily with the most high quality food. So at the end of that book, she does become a little bit more of a mail journalist and a little bit less of an investigative reporter, but it is an interesting read. But as you go into the modern day fraud, we still have an issue with these preservatives and additives which keep our food safe and make it last for as long as we need it to last. Sometimes they're overused or they're used illegally. And again, the supply chain issue came up a few years ago with Sudan coming into a Worcester sauce. So it was going into a spice, which went into a Worcester sauce, which went into a million different foods. No food safety risk at all, but an illegal use of an additive. We still see high-value foods, and now more frequently, protected origin foods. So protected designated origin foods are probably one of the bigger targets now that we see in Europe. As the protected origin foods proliferate, so do the fraudsters' attempts. There's a great sheep's cheese that they sell in northern Spain, and it can only be made from one type of sheep, and there are only 20,000 sheep in northern Spain. It's sold in Spain and France, and when they totted up how much was sold, enough was sold to come from 200,000 sheep. And so they did some genetic work to try and understand the markers from the sheep, and they found some French sheep had been used to make this Spanish cheese, and there was quite a big issue in Europe around French and Spanish sheep, but they were a different breed, and again, that's the modern style of adulteration that we'll see. If it's a high value commodity or a protected origin food where you can charge a bit more money, somebody could make a bit of money out of it. And it does become harder if it's still cheese. Cheese and cheese next to each other don't really look that much different. You need to use more powerful analytical techniques to understand those. We'll still see high volume commodities like milk powder, coffee, tea being adulterated. And then a new area, perhaps again with the rise of chemistry, is the nature identical or natural. So vanilla, we know what chemical gives vanilla its flavour, its vanillin. That's a good example. And you can make vanillin very cheaply. So you can make a vanilla essence much cheaper than you can to distill a vanilla essence using a chemical route. Being able to tell the difference of those is something you'll hear about a little bit later on with the isotope dilution analysis. And one last fraud, not necessarily a fraud, but again an adulteration, is GMO. In Europe, we're not great fans of genetically modified foods, and they don't tend to get very much approval in the EU. But in other parts of the world, there are several genetically modified foods which are allowed and perfectly allowable within the food chain, which makes it quite difficult if you're importing into Europe from somewhere else to make sure that the material you're importing is GMO-free completely. And so, is it a fraud or is it an adulteration? Probably not, but it becomes part of those food fraud laws. I've got two flies flying across the front of the screen.
Horse flies.
Yeah. No, that was a horse fly, but then we have a So then we have the fall of legislation. So we've got a lot of legislation, and perhaps sometimes some might say too much. Horsegate, as it's often known in our laboratory, and the role of the FSA have been really criticised recently through several reports, Pat Troop's report in particular. I think the legislative issues that have arisen from that will mean that there will be some more changes along that. But perhaps more importantly is that as we go through our lean times and our local authorities' budgets have been squeezed, there's no trade and standards officers yet left. They're the people who actually need to go and look for that fraud. So as a manufacturer, you can report and say, I think somebody's fraudulently making our product or substituting our product. But if there's not enough trading standards officers and there's not enough public analyst labs to do the analysis, then the prosecutions won't come. And generally we find now that trading standards officers are really only interested when there's a danger to the public health. So if it's a food fraud where there's a real issue around health of the consumer, if it's a brand issue, it's much harder to get them to take interest. So how do we need to think now? Well, we need to think like a fraudster. What will be next? And this involves some intelligent-led prediction. It's a hard thing to say for the FSA, intelligence-led. We'll see whether they can do that or not. But actually, that's what they're trying to do, and they're making a really good job of it. They're, instead of looking and just seeing what data is coming in, they're also thinking more broadly. So they are using the equations and mass balances. How much wheat was produced last year? Is that enough to make the things that we make out of wheat? No. What else is someone going to put in instead? So it's thinking a little bit more broadly around the whole issue. They also will need to prioritise public safety for cancer and kill, the melamine issue. Several thousand children died in China. Still an issue in terms of things like glycols used in place of other things in wine. And now we're also looking for new analytical tools. So Barbara will talk later around DNA. But we're always playing cat and mouse and trying to catch up with the fraudsters. And we have a complexity of supply chain, so that hasn't really changed. So we are now reliant on audits and auditors, and auditors actually being able to dig down and underneath and get through the layers of paperwork of a complex supply chain to understand what's changed. But we also have to deal with the changing public perception and the influence of the press. So is GMO really an adulteration? Clean label is a really big thing now, so if you've got a clean label, but then there are some preservatives which may or may not be clean label. And also diet products, and how the public perceive those kinds of specialist products. So just to summarise, adulteration could be fraud, but historically it was around a need or a need to improve things. It wasn't necessarily meant to defraud us in those days. As society, we've changed in the way we think about adulteration, and we're changing still, especially things like Fallscape coming up. Everybody's mind moved from food safety to authenticity. For the most part, adulteration is now economic, and it's around making a bit of money on the side. Legislation plays its part, as does the auditing and inspection, and the analysis methods must keep pace with the fraudsters. I think that's all I have to say.